Welcome to Sage Against the Machine. I'm Irene Supre.
And I'm Sandy Skies.
In a world drowning in knowledge, we're seeking wisdom.
We're here to explore systems that increase the health and well-being of humanity and the natural world.
We'll be in conversation with artists, scientists, tacticians, thinkers, and advocates about solutions to today's polycrisis.
Let's get started.
Our guest today, Dr. Kyra Bobinet, is an expert in healthcare innovation and has passionately pursued the science of behavior change. In fact, she's a self-described behavior designer. She has a master's degree in public health from Harvard, and her work is focused on technology-enabled behavior change, behavioral neuroscience, and health disparities. CEO and founder of Fresh Try, a science-based wellness and mindset training app. Her new book, Unstoppable Brain, the new neuroscience that frees us from failure, eases our stress, and creates lasting change, delves into the power of iteration in overcoming failure disease and maintaining motivation. I want in.
Amen.
Hi. Welcome, Kyra.
Hi, Kyra.
It's so lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have this conversation. So you're a medical doctor who's focused on neuroscience as a means of helping people get healthier in their whole body. Mm-hmm. For those of us new to this neuroscience space, neurobiology, can you just ground us in some basics? Tell us a little bit about your work and some of the brain research that underpins it.
Yeah, so I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into neuroscience. I wouldn't call myself a neuroscientist, and some people accidentally call me that sometimes, but that's left up to
corrected.
The smarter people in the world.
Okay.
Yeah, that's for the smarter people in the world. So I take their brilliant ideas and their bench scientists, and I actually started off before becoming a doctor. I was a bench scientist for a long time, and so, you know, very grounded in the basic sciences, but not in the neuroscience side. I was more in oncology. So yeah, I started out in bench science in my career, went into medical school, went into nonprofit behavior change with incarcerated youth, people coming out of incarceration, and then went into public health, then went into behavior design. So neuroscience was just a vehicle along the way as I was trying to solve certain things that I was seeing on the behavioral side. I was like, what's causing this? And also, how can we solve this? And so no one needs to be intimidated by the brain, because there's only a couple things really that are important in terms of behavior that you should know. You know, everybody knows fight or flight, you know, they know about their amygdala being, you know, kind of the area of fear, you know, like the tiger jumping out of the woods. And those of us who listen to that historically lived and had children, and that's who we are, those were our descendants. And maybe, you know, kind of addiction medicine, like the new concepts in addiction medicine, I think is important to cover. So one of the most recent and helpful paradigms in addiction medicine that we can use for our conversation today is that, let's say we're at zero in terms of our pain pleasure scale, but then we go after a cookie or something like that, and that goes 1 point to the pleasure side of things. The current thinking on addiction medicine is that by tilting over to the pleasure side 1 point, the brain will always compensate 2 points backwards for pain. And that's what drives the feeling of craving, right, of chasing dopamine, of chasing dopamine that people get into. And that's why the most recent trend in addiction medicine is dopamine fasting. You're being able to reset back to zero, because you start getting in this loop. And you're kind of like drifting over to the pain side of that equation. So that's a really important principle to kind of just pin for the moment, because there's so much. And then I think a lot of people also understand a little bit about reward pathway, in terms of that dopamine chase and, you know, kind of chasing the dopamine and looking for the next high and that kind of thing. But we'll unpack that a little bit more, especially as it comes to this new neuroscience around motivation and behavior change and long-term behavior change that kind of intersects with that. Mm-hmm. What questions do you have?
Wow, so many.
I just want to go back to that addiction again and make sure that I'm clear and that I understand what you said. If we move 1 point to the pleasure, you said we go 2 points to, because we've reset zero to one. Is that what you just said? Is that it, the way to?
It's the overcompensation of balance in the brain. Okay. This is also supported by like the Nobel Prize in loss aversion and behavioral economics that shows like, you know, loss, we're two times as sensitive to loss as we are to gain when it comes to sales, you know, like, you know, this is a limited time only, or there's only three left, or those kinds of things. That loss sensitivity is a 2x signal to a gain. So if I give you $20, you know, and I take away 10, that's kind of the ratio of things, if that makes sense. And it's consistent.
Right. Two steps forward, one step back.
No, it's more like one step forward, two steps back.
Yeah, let me get that. One step forward, two steps back. That's horrible.
Exactly. Right. That's horrible.
It explains so much, but it protects us. Yeah.
Doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And those are the kinds of things that we're lucky to be alive right now, because those are the kinds of things that we were kind of thinking that we were rational in economics and also in human behavior about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And so once behavioral economics figured out this whole, like, you know, one step forward, two steps back on the money side, then I think that kind of, you know, inspired maybe this more recent thinking in addiction medicine to understand how the brain is overcompensating in the negative direction, which is why you get people with addictions, really strong addictions, saying things like, I don't do my drug to get high. I do it to feel normal. They're just trying to get back to zero, and they can never get back to zero.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
Because they set up this one forward, two back situation. And of course, you do the math over time, you just keep getting further and further away from zero.
And that extrapolates to shopping addictions, to drugs, to phone. Yeah, absolutely.
When I was at Stanford at the Behavior Design Lab, early on, this is like, you know, 2012, so the iPhones had been out. They were probably 50% saturated in the market of smartphones versus flip phones. And what we found in our studies around emotion and drivers of use of phone, and particularly apps, is that, and this is the same lab that like the founders of Instagram came out of, you know, so it was a very fundamentally persuasive tech kind of lab with BJ Fogg. And myself and my graduate student found that, you know, the thing that was prompting people wasn't these reminders on the phones or the notifications or the buzzing or any of that kind of stuff. It was the internal trigger of a little bit of agita, a little bit of like, I wonder what's happening with the weather. I wonder what's happening with the news. You know, that we self-trigger with anxiety and then we pick up our phone. And so that's the same kind of thing, is that we're having this event, and that particular trigger is connected to this new area of the brain called the habenula, which is where all of my questing, all of my, like, why won't people change? Why does everything I try work for a little while, both for myself and the people that I'm trying to serve? And then we all relapse. What's going on? You know, nothing lasts. Mm-hmm. And every new gadget that came out, every new program that came out that had evidence behind it, it all operated the same way, which was like mostly relapse. Eventually, almost all relapse.
And there's a psychological term for that. I read something about that.
I recently, how I came to it was organically. I was doing a clinical study with Duke University School of Medicine, and we were studying metabolic syndrome and mindfulness, because in those days I was like, well, now mindfulness is all the rage. And, you know, I was convinced that the prefrontal cortex was the issue and the default mode network and all the rumination and depression coming off of that. And we'll get to that in a second, because that was now debunked, or is being debunked real time by this new neuroscience. But in those days, I had an interim conversation with one of our patients in the treatment arm. And I said, so how's it going? You know, weight loss and all these things. And she's, you know, using mindfulness. And she said, oh, you know, it's going great. I'm losing weight. I'm exercising. I'm doing much better, that kind of thing. But then she pauses and she's like, but I know what I should do. I just don't know why I don't do it. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, thank you for that life plan. You know, like, that's what I've been hunting for decades. And I didn't know. She just put her finger on the nerve. And then come to find out, that was probably like 15 years ago, come to find out that actually has been codified as the no-do gap in psychology. So I know what to do. I just don't do it. Uh-huh. That's the no-do gap. And that is at the heart of everything that we're talking about. When we talk about behavior change, we're really talking about the no-do gap, aren't we? Because, you know, whether it's trying to get yourself to eat better, trying yourself to get, you know, get yourself to go to sleep better, or any other, you know, relationships, work habits, whatever the case may be, it's all this gap between what I know is good for me and what I actually do.
And so you like this, the habenula, right? We all know what the amygdala is. But the new word of the day is habenula. So
yeah,
I want
everybody to know about the words habenula.
Tell us about that.
H-A-B-E-N-U-L-A.
Habenula.
Habenula. And plural, there's two of them, habenulae, because there's one on either side, but they're like right in the middle line. If I went like straight back with my fingers, it's just above an area called the thalamus, and it's a half a centimeter, and it's right in front of the pineal gland, which, you know, releases a lot of DMT and things like that. So the habenula basically is the source of all of our aversion to things. You know, it causes us, you know, in the same way that the amygdala was like, that's a tiger in the bush. This is, you know, I eat a poisonous plant as a hunter-gatherer. I don't want to, it gives me a bellyache and I don't want to eat that plant again. You know, so I learn. I learn not to touch the hot stove more than once. And so it saves us from toxic or dangerous or life-threatening repeat behaviors, right? And even causes us to learn from other people, you know, because we can learn from other people's, you know, stories of demise or problems. And so the amygdala basically is sensitive to, it's a failure detector and all the cousins of failure, which I'll talk about in a second. And it turns on when we think we failed at something or we think it's going to fail.
Oh.
So it's anticipating failure and you know, negative outcomes. You could also substitute disappointment, disillusionment, demoralization, disempowerment.
Is it a fairly reliable sensing? Because you said it senses that we might fail or when we failed. I mean, I can understand the amygdala saying, that's a tiger, I need to run, versus this looks like it's going to fail, that's my habenula. Can we mistake failure?
Can it be overactive?
Exactly.
It can be overactive.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, it can be overactive. It can be trained to be overactive. And the other thing that's powerful, so it actually does have relays to the amygdala, to the prefrontal cortex. It has control over the reward pathway. It has control over the serotonin system. This thing is the hub of everything that matters to our behavior.
Wow.
And so it determines what we will and what we won't do. So when it comes to the no-do gap, whenever there's a no-do gap, I want everybody to pay attention that your amygdala is on, meaning there's something preventing you from doing what you know you should do.
I don't want to sidetrack too far on this, but having dealt with people in my family with ADHD,
mm-hmm.
is there some correlation between the habenula and why people with ADHD can't complete and they procrastinate? And it's really a challenge for people, a very painful challenge.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's some schools of thought that ADHD is a couple different conditions. So I know with my family, there's a lot of PTSD in my family. I'm Native American and white, so I'm a biracial person.
Mm.
On the Native side, there's a lot of PTSD, my mom and my sister, and also my adopted sister. And so there is it's a protective mechanism for the brain to kind of, you know, not summon all the unwanted memories. You know, uh-huh. and just keep moving on, you know, the impulsivity. But there's also been some early studies, and there's actually, you know, for those neuroscientists who might be listening, I want to recognize that there are lateral and medial aspects of the habenula. And there's a lot of studies right now trying to sort out, because one of them is like an on and off button, like to put it that way. And so it makes it a little bit more complicated to describe. But yes, in short, what you're observing is correct, which is that if you have an impaired habenula, you see more impulsive behaviors. Another study in support of this was one recently in the UK, where they found that young men who had unfortunately died of a heroin overdose had shrunken habenula, implying that the heroin, the addictive substance, was suppressing somehow the normal function of the habenula to stop the dangerous behavior. Because the best way to think about this is that the habenula is your brakes on your car.
Mm.
And just like in a car, if you're flooring the gas, you know, dopamine system is the gas. If you're flooring dopamine and motivation to do something, but your brakes are on because of failure or past failure or fear of failure, then you're not going anywhere. And so then that causes this no-do gap of like the brakes are on.
But I think that's so interesting because you just said, if you have the brakes on and you only have dopamine, which would be a heroin addiction, right? So your habenula
is off. The brakes are impaired.
They're impaired. So they're not even, they're not saying this is too much dopamine. This isn't good for me versus
at the beginning, and nobody's done the time course of this because these are all autopsies. But the hypothesis is that in the beginning of the addiction, as it starts to take hold, there's a normal, healthy habenula. But what you're seeing in these autopsies is a habenula that has been suppressed and shrunken over time because the addictive substance is the only thing that shut up the pain of the habenula. Mm. And then other studies, you know, to fill in the picture a little bit more, other studies have shown that the habenula is at least one, if not the strongest culprit of this withdrawal symptoms from the addictive substance. So when I have a craving for the heroin, it's because, you know, we talked about that pain and pleasure thing. So if I go one towards the pleasure looking for the heroin, and then I get these two notches to the left of pain, then basically the habenula is the mechanism by which that pain is happening. And that makes me want to take more heroin to get back to zero, right? And I can't get back there. And the habenula keeps moving me away. So of course, then I'm going to suppress the brain's going to suppress the habenula, like, hey, just chill out, you know? And over time, I become less and less inhibited.
It just stops less functioning. Less,
right, right.
Yes. Yeah. And so we think maybe addiction and ADHD have some similar qualities in the same way that, you know, if you think about the feedback loop, if I am distracted and I'm like trying to avoid, it's, you know, habenula is
avoidance.
I'm trying to avoid the painful memory or the whatever, or the focus or the feeling,
the trigger,
that I'm gonna fail,
or whatever
to focus,
it is. Yeah,
whatever it is, then I'm going to be loose and, you know, kind of impulsive chasing after that dopamine, right? I'm going to be really like unstable in my focus. And the habenula then shrinks down and down and down, like, well, you don't need me here, you know, and so use it or lose it kind of kicks in. So that's some early thinking about how that all might be working together.
So thank you for just, you know, my mind just immediately went, wow, okay, this is, this is great new science, you know, and considering it, you know, just talking about addiction, drug addiction, you know, the plague on this nation and on young people of this nation is so horrible. To me, this is a map point to head for. This gives me hope, you know, Kyra, right. It's really,
it gives me hope
as a person in our country, looking at the blight that, you know, we've lost so many people, so many family members have lost people. So, thank you for that.
I have a question. So we talked a lot about what happens if the habenula shrinks and goes away and stops performing. Are there situations, and have you studied what happens if it becomes overactive? Is that good or bad?
So the overactive state, or the on state, you know, on the other end of that coin, on the other end of that spectrum, I should say, is that you have a habenula that is really easily triggered. And triggered by perceptions of failure. So somebody who's really sensitive to the idea that they're going to fail, or that they failed so much in the past. So think about like just the intergenerational effects of racism and oppression, and even in a one lifespan, how many times as you get older, how many times you're like, been there, done that, you know, or all or none thinking kind of kicks in. Those kinds of things are indicators that this person has a habenula that's just a little bit too sensitive. And then the other thing that has been coming out even in the last 4 years since COVID is a whole body of literature around linking the habenula as the cause, not just a player in, but as the cause of depression, anxiety, and OCD kind of symptoms, which prior to this revelation, we all thought that it was the prefrontal cortex ruminating.
Right. That just makes so much sense to me, because if you have an overactive habenula and it just keeps telling you, don't try, and you just become lethargic, you give up, or you...
Anxiety.
A lot of anxiety. Yeah. I can imagine how it freezes you. So it actually, your habenula needs to be calibrated to be performing at its peak.
Yeah. And so to unpack the prefrontal cortex habenula, they have a relationship, and the habenula has power over prefrontal cortex. So again, it's like the dashboard, has all the power controls for all these other areas. And so the prefrontal cortex is more like, you know, yeah, you have ruminations and you have, you know, personal narrative in there, and you have the possibility of executive control, but it's almost like the cloud system, you know, and, you know, the kind of rumination system of like, how am I doing? What do they think of me? All that kind of stuff that gets triggered off. It's the cloud system that gets set up, but it's the habenula of like, that's not going to work out for you, or they don't like you, or like that kind of like lightning strike to ground that uses the cloud system. And so if you have a really strong habit of having negative self-talk, that's a setup for a habenula to just pull one off the shelf and be like, you know, and stop you in your tracks from doing something productive and getting stuck and into a no-do gap, right? Because you're not doing anything for your own best interest.
Right.
And there's a psychological term for that, which is called helplessness, or learned helplessness, which, you know, has, when it's applied to humans, I don't like it, because it was originally developed in animal research, and really cruel animal research with dogs, where they would have them in these cages and they would shock their feet with the door closed, latched. And at first they would yelp and cry and dig and try to get out like crazy. And then after a while, they noticed that they just took it.
Yeah, because they couldn't get out.
And so the habenula was on. This isn't going to work out for you. Might as well stop trying. You know, killed motivation. So, you know, the habenula, failure detector. Number two, motivation kill switch. It will kill your motivation to keep trying that thing. Again, trying to save your life, trying to keep you from doing something harmful to yourself, like, you know, doing something futile. But it's predicting whether something's futile or not for you. And it's oftentimes wrong, especially when it comes to empowering ourselves to do something better for ourselves. So whenever we see ourselves or somebody else in a disempowered state, and I like to use disempowerment or motivation loss instead of helplessness, because that's that can be used as a judgmental term.
Well, and it gives you a place to go.
Right.
Right. It gives us a place to go.
And I was thinking of the word victim.
Yeah.
That self-identity as a victim. I'm a victim in this. I feel like that there's a play there. And I'm thinking more in the sociocultural dimension of groups of people who feel victimized. They're powerless.
Well, this sort of brings us to the work and the solutions that you've come up with. Right. So let's talk about, you know, Sandy was looking at Fresh Try site, and she saw that line, as long as you're trying, you're winning. And like, so let's go there and extrapolate from there the method that you've created and all your research has led to that gives us all hope.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That's the point. It's like, you know, this is not the end of the story. It's just that it's an essential piece of knowledge that everybody should know about going forward, because we've had a giant misunderstanding. And one of the consequences of not knowing that you have a habenula is that you see yourself not do what you know you should do. And then what do you do next?
Shame.
You hate yourself.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You feel bad about yourself. Yeah, there's self-loathing, there's shame, guilt, self-blame, victim, as you were talking about, Sandy. So in order to find the way out, you know, I had done a bunch of research on frontline workers. These are people who, you know, make minimum wage and have every probable, you know, health disparity in the world, every social determinant of health that you could imagine in public health terms. They were all over the country, and they worked for a really large jumbo employer. And I was contracted to find what is it that works for health, like health management? Like what's working? Because everything out there, all the programs, and I agree, all these other programs that I had personally tried and, you know, they all ended up in relapse, you know, weren't working. And so we had to start from first principles. And what I found was that there was this very, very tiny minority of people who I like to call the MacGyvers, and I'll talk about that in a second, who were figuring out what worked for them as the solution. Like their focus was on experimentation, on practice, like you would practice a musical instrument or a sport or some other skill. And then when they got thwarted or when they hit an impasse, what they did differently and uniquely, and only this was the only thing they all shared in common, was that they would iterate. And so that's the second word of the day, which is iteration, which is, you know, tweaking and tinkering and adjusting and adapting and experimenting and being creative and the figuring outness of things, right? That's what they did differently. And in to a person, they were the only ones who were able to maintain long-term behavior change, whether it was weight loss or getting off their medicines, living a good life, you know, and they didn't have all the money in the world, or they didn't have whatever, but they were okay because they were empowered to iterate their way through life.
Huh.
And iteration is kind of part of, have you all heard of Carol Dweck and her work, Mindset,
no.
Growth Mindset?
No.
Okay. So there's this thing called Growth Mindset, and this
is Carol Dweck. Mindset. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Carol Dweck's at Stanford. When she was an early PhD, she actually divided the world of behavior and mindset into two mindset classes. One of them was learning mindsets, and the other one was performance mindsets. And as the world of, you know, mindset research has evolved, more and more research piled up, and it showed that performance mindsets, while good in the short term and for very like discrete tasks and for people with very high confidence in that area that they were trying in, the downside of those is that it leads to maladaptive behaviors, you know, eating disorders in the case of health and dieting, lying, cheating,
right.
You know, stealing, what, you know, and even at work, like in work productivity terms, people devalued hard work, you know, so there's always work performance goals and measurements, things like that are just ubiquitous. They're in every single company,
yeah.
You know? And in fact, it's creating this big system of dishonesty, inauthenticity.
And unintended impact.
Right.
Yeah. When you're handed a key performance yeah, indicator,
right.
After a while, you're like,
whoopsie.
Yeah, yeah. It's okay. Not very motivational.
Right. All right.
Right. It's hard to own
That's
it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all like Charlie Munger, you know, said, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the behavior, or I'll show you the outcome.
yeah,
and that's kind of,
right.
That's kind of what this happened. Yeah. So iteration is under the more like learning class, but it's a specific kind of learning, which is a puzzling kind of quality to it, which is different than just growth mindset, which is where you believe that's not all over for you. That's a wonderful step. That is a revolutionary step. But I believe that now this iteration, that this discovery of iterative mindset and doing it this way adds to and actually expounds on the chances of success and the probability of success of growth mindset. Because in growth mindset research, there's some limitations to outcomes that people have. Because while they might believe it's not over for me, they don't know what to do instead. Whereas iteration points the direction of what to do to get yourself out of there.
Wow.
And those were the MacGyvers. And MacGyver was a popular TV show a long time ago. And then they
for
remade
you
it
little
in 2016.
Youngsters out there. He could create a nuclear bomb or disarm a nuclear bomb with a chewing gum wrapper and a paperclip.
Exactly. That's what happens when you're MacGyver.
It's ingenuity
and cleverness and figuring it out and working with what is, you know, that's what they did the best. And you know, flash forward 6 years and we've done research on, you know, thousands of people and have found two over and over again that the level of iterative mindset that you have is correlated to your long-term results in health and in mental health.
Yeah, that was what we were wondering about. We were talking about this yesterday. So your focus has been on health and well-being, mm-hmm. right? But you actually posit that this can be helpful in increasing people's happiness. You know, it moves well beyond our behavior around what we eat or, you know, just our day-to-day behavior. And I really was thinking about this because I know you've done a lot of work around meditation and mindfulness. How do those intersect? And how does that affect just our general happiness? How can an iterative mindset actually increase our happiness?
Yeah. So from the point of view of neuroscience, mindfulness is it's a mixture of active ingredients. So one active ingredient that comes to mind is loving kindness, you know, as part of that bundle, if you will. And if I have loving kindness for myself, then guess what? I'm going to be able to be resilient to the failures or the perceptions of failures that would otherwise turn on my habenula and kill my motivation to keep trying. And by the way, the motivation is lost in the night. It's a thief in the night. It's silent. There's no like, ouch, my motivation's lost. You know, it's like you just wake up the next morning, you don't feel like doing it. And then you blame yourself for not doing it. So loving kindness is an example. Another one is like beginner's mind from that, you know, Buddhist tradition that became secularized. And, you know, beginner's mind is like start over again, like, or just be, you know, don't have any expectations that you're some expert or that this is going to be turning out a certain way. You know, that leaves you with what's called cognitive flexibility, which is another favorite thing that I love in neuroscience and psychology is, you know, that's the kind of thing that allows you to bounce back quickly from these failure thoughts, from the prospect of like, I might fail, like, nope. Because even if you catch yourself failing and you lost your motivation, you're like, oh, I'm in a no-do gap. Uh-oh. You don't wallow there long if you know what you're doing.
Right.
And if you know how to apply mindfulness and those kinds of things, these are recipes and tools to keep you going. However, that said, I think iteration is meta to them all. To me, that is the most generalizable and safe active ingredient for keeping the habenula off that I've ever seen. In practice. And so it's the most protective factor I've found.
Right. And the iteration is tinkering. It's the curiosity. It's the, well, that didn't work. Let me try this. And the belief that the trying something different may or may not work, but you'll just keep trying until it does.
That's right.
Which brings me to the macro question, because what Irene and I are curious about and why we're in conversation with leaders like yourself is, we're learning things at the individual and micro level that can be applied to the big cultural systems problems we're seeing. So I'm curious how you can imagine what we are learning about the habenula and this idea of iteration, and that's an adaptability, a strength, or I don't have the right words for it, but what
capacity, yeah, building right, capacity.
Exactly. That iteration capacity.
Adaptability.
We're going to need it. Because everything we're facing is like nothing any of us have seen before. Climate change.
Polycrisis.
Yeah. Right. So for me, this is, oh my God, we finally now know what to pay attention to at the individual level. If we could do it at the collective level, we can move faster. Because I'm all about, we don't have a lot of time. We need to move fast. Mm-hmm. Behavior change mm-hmm. is required if we're going to reinvent all the systems that need reinventing in order for us to avoid catastrophic climate change or societal breakdown.
And you do this at scale in organizations, right? You have applied this, or you're exploring this idea of how do we scale this?
Yeah. In my book, in the Unstoppable Brain book, the last chapter is dedicated to something I like to call the collective habenula. Because you know what you're pointing to—that's
beautiful.
What you're pointing to is a state of mass disempowerment. Oh, nothing ever matters.
Right.
We stop recycling.
Right.
This is just going to go in the landfill anyway.
I can't
stop
do
recycling.
It. Exactly.
This is
too much.
Gonna, like, you know, I am too help. It's the state of helplessness and powerlessness and motivation loss that we talked about. So in our current times, the most important skill that we are looking at, you know, Sandy, that you're talking about, the advent of the most important skill is the ability to keep going.
Yes.
Because if you think about everything out there, that everything out there, it doesn't matter if it's out there as long as you can keep going. So right now we're living in the era of the success paradox, which is managing the failure is far more significant and important than managing the success.
Yes.
We've come through this, like, you know, Drucker School of Business, all this stuff.
Yeah.
That's like success, my five principles of success. Here's all the, you know, practices and habits of success. No. Whoever neutralizes their failure the most, and if you think about the people that agitate you, that you wish they didn't live on this planet with you, and you wish they weren't doing what they were doing, and that they didn't have that much power and influence.
Oh boy.
The thing that bothers you about them is that they don't think they failed, or at least they don't appear to be thinking that they failed, and they're relentless as a result, and they're persistent as a result, and they keep iterating their way through what you think should have killed them off or stopped them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And whether that is a person, or
an idea,
an idea, or whatever the case may be, it is who is the last group standing with their habenula off.
Wow,
that is going to predict what happens, and that's why you have a lot of relentlessness coming from people who have, you know, who are on the spectrum in some regards, because they're not afflicted with some of the other neuromachinery of empathy and things that cause failure to happen in people who have really tender hearts, who really care. And so they get to almost be in a reptile and go through and like not care about people, and then just do what makes money or what exploits the earth or whatever the case may be. And that grates on the nerves of the rest of us because we are having a habenula hit from that.
And this is how a more iterative, persistent minority can impose its will on a majority that feels helpless. And I, for one, I just want to point out, I hope I'm always afflicted with empathy. I have an empathy
That's
affliction.
Fine. I hope you
and
are
I'm
too.
Proud of it. Thank you. I Good. Really appreciate Good. You framing it all that way.
Right. But here's the missing piece, right, for you, is that somebody with an overactive sense of empathy, like my daughter has this, is prone to pre-failing. And I go into this in the book in terms of like all the different forms of failure, all the different diseases of failure disease. And one of the categories is pre-failing. It's like, oh, well, that's not going to work out because of whatever. But that's because the empathy is leading and there's not a knowledge of caring for any perception of failure in all of its forms.
And I have seen that in young people. We both mentor a lot of young people, and I've seen that in some young people, and now I understand it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's really, I believe that people, once they understand, it's like the human family lived at a time when they didn't know they had a liver, you know? Or they didn't know they had spleen or appendix. So now we're in the era where we're like, oh, we have a habenula, and that's what it does. So I think it's really going to open up whole vast swaths of human empowerment that have been unfortunately sequestered and neutralized and killed off and motivation loss through our very overly performative societal structures.
Right.
Because performing is everywhere. SMART goals is everywhere. You know, like goals didn't really exist before 1945 in the post-World War II era. So 70 years of this performance, you know, shackling and
drive toward.
Getting somewhere, achieving something.
For other people.
Right.
Being human-centric.
Being
all of that. We've
centered.
The consumptive mindset of I have to have this thing to prove that I am successful. That's all part of that same equation. So take us into that last chapter and the discussion about the collective habenula. And where's your hope? What can we do to amplify and illustrate that there's the possibility of healing our collective habenula?
Yeah. So what's going to happen in the future is absolutely determined by the collective habenula. You know, like I said, whatever group has the belief that they're going to succeed, just like in a sports game. You can see momentum shift from one team to the other, and the other teams start to get demoralized, aka failure is predicting in their minds, and their habenulas are on. And it just takes a little bit out of their effort. Just all it takes is a little effort loss. And so that relentlessness, that vibrancy, you know, we're dealing with, you know, mass amounts of burnout. What is burnout besides failure and helplessness that I can't do this job in the way that it needs to get done, or nothing I do matters? You know, that is burnout. That is a very distinctive clinical description. And so I believe that the way out of burnout and to recover the human energy and the human heart and the human power that we have, because we are a collaborative species.
Yes.
And if we can't be effortful and collaborative with each other in relationship with each other and the natural world, then that's what's causing all this illness in ourselves and in our larger, you know, polycrisis, I think you said, Irene.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the hope, is that if we can recover and get out of being stuck, and by the way, the habenula is associated with those addictions, because when our habenula is on, it's so itchy and it's so uncomfortable, and we're on this, the pain side of the zero, right? And so we just want to like make it stop. And so maybe it's not heroin, but maybe it's just spending too much time on your phone, doom scrolling or watching stuff, watching TikTok or those kinds of things. That is a loss of human energy that could be used towards this thing, because that's a disempowered state to be in a distracting, numbing state of addiction. So pulling people out of this mass addiction, pulling them out of motivation loss, understanding the proper diagnosis of what's happening to yourself so that you can stop blaming yourself and recover some of your own belief in yourself and your own enthusiasm and meaning and purpose in life, and recover your motivation and protect it whenever there's the specter of failure, protecting that motivation like it's the most precious thing in the world, because it is.
Wow.
Especially now.
Let's talk about parents right now. I can't even imagine, as a doctor who does the kind of research you do, walking out in public anywhere or sitting in a restaurant or watching people in the park. I'll be watching people in the park across the street from my house, literally looking at their phones while they're walking their dogs. They're not looking up at all at the beauty around them, the animals, the ducks, you know. I can't imagine what it's like as a doctor to constantly be seeing the pathology that you're working on. And do you have advice for parents around, like, what has your research shown you around young people and children and this media and phone addiction? Because, you know, we're seeing one-year-olds, right, who know how to open an iPad and go to a show they want to watch. It's pretty crazy, actually, in my view.
But oh, yeah.
What do you have some advice for people? What has your research shown around that? And what can parents do to not fall into that trap?
Yeah. And that is the most important sign of our collective disempowerment, is our susceptibility to these distraction addictions.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was at Stanford on a panel early on in the Facebook story, there was a young man who sat next to me who was working at Google, and he had been acquired by Google. And his name was Tristan Harris. And he then went on to create a movie called The Social Dilemma, and
yes,
is working very heavily on this hijacking, this you know,
yes,
kind of inhabitance of an exploitation of the neuroscience for this purpose, you know, which is just to have attention,
yeah,
on the product.
Every sip of your attention is what they want. Sip.
But then we offer it, it because of these things that I was talking about with,
right,
the work we did at Stanford and the anxiety that we stimulate ourselves,
yeah,
to take the drug, because,
yeah,
we don't understand this balance of pleasure and pain. And I was really sobered earlier. I mean, because I'm in there too. And so are you. And so are you. I mean,
yeah,
everyone
yes. Yes.
uses a little too much phone, mm-hmm, these days, uh-huh, a little too quickly, a little too helplessly without realizing it.
Right.
And there's a pervasiveness of this mindlessness that's going on. So, Irene, I think a couple parts to your question. Number one, the parents, I have compassion.
Mm.
But the truth is that their kids will have less mental health. They will have less focus. They will have less social skills than the generation before them, unless there is something policy-wise we can do to literally stop the dosing of this, you know? And I do believe we can do this. There was times in human history where everybody drank alcohol as water because the water was poisoned, right?
Yes,
and so
right,
did the kids.
Right.
So did the kids.
Right. Here's right. your mead for dinner.
And we had fetal alcohol syndromes. And we had all kinds of impairments to cognition and to human development and things like that. So I think we're going to see a surge of that. My sister is a first grade teacher. She's seen this behaviorally in her students where these are the kids of parents who grew up looking at their phone instead of at their kid.
Yeah.
And so we have a mass experiment of child neglect, digital neglect of children, as well as children becoming addicts also. And it is really terrible to watch at the point that we're at. But I also like to focus on what is working and that we will wake up and that we will see the consequences of our actions because nature will show them to us because we can't change our biology to go along with that. It's ultimately going to show us what the truth is. So it is painful. And, you know, whatever your practice is of just like releasing your empathy and pain and your compassion and like resetting, you know,
yeah,
so that,
right.
you that you don't sit in that suffering.
No, that's true.
We all, right. we all have to do that. We all have to kind of like, you know, lay on the earth and just give it over to something greater than ourselves because we have to reset and we have to turn our habenulas off and be like, what can I do?
And grandparents, I'm a grandmother.
Same.
And I tell my kids, my grandkids, no, nope, not at Yaya's house.
Right.
You're not yep. looking at the iPad. Good. We're not, we play board Good. Games. We, you know.
And your kids are older. My one granddaughter who's just turned 9 months today. And what I'm observing with her parents and their cadre of friends, they are all very interested in legislation that prevents kids from having social media accounts until they're 16. It's interesting
agree,
in a conversation,
yeah.
all these young parents are like, my kid isn't getting a phone or social media, and we should have a law. Like, if you don't want to regulate the companies, just regulate the age. We have age limits on all the other things. So I'm observing this young cohort of new parents who did grow up in all of this and see the harm and are responding to
and
it.
They want more.
And they want more controls.
And, you know, that's yeah. another show, I mean, paralysis right. of our government
right.
and its inability to actually
right.
meet this moment.
The habenula of the government.
yeah, you need to go to Congress. Kyra, yeah. you need to brief Congress.
On the MacGyver mind.
Yeah.
This has just been a wonderful conversation.
I do have one more question for you. Your identity as an Indigenous person and a member of the Ojibwe tribe, right?
Yes, yes. Leech Lake.
Yeah. How has that impacted the way that you look at health disparity in this country? Because it's well documented, you know, the health outcomes for Native Americans and Indigenous people in this country. Tell me how that has impacted your work.
Yeah, it's a great dovetail of what you were describing in terms of the helplessness that you feel when you see, you know, these mass injuries to children and families happening with the digital world. Because what it's like to grow up as an Indigenous person, especially who is mixed race and so is not taken on face, I kind of get to sneak, I get to pose as both in my life, is that my people come from the lowest amount of money spent on their healthcare. The IHS has the lowest amount of money per capita of any healthcare system. We have we're the smallest of all of the measured, you know, minority groups in this country. We have a genocide that's really largely gone unaccounted for and also makes people squeamish when you discuss it. And so there's a lot of like discomfort in just even people knowing that you're Native.
And a lot of effort, let's be honest, a lot of effort to squelch that history, period.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. My mom was a boarding school survivor. So we lost our language at her generation. Mm. She was taken from her family at age 5 and put in to a boarding school with 100 other kids in a room. Can you imagine as a 5-year-old and then taken away from your family and then hit if you spoke Ojibwe? And so there's compounded social and societal and racial and health. And yet there are, I'm connected to language teachers and people, and I give money to a language immersion school and to support that for my tribe. And, you know, basically finding whatever way I can to really, you know, reduce suffering and to open up opportunity. And so some of the things that I do is I bring family members here and I help them to heal and I talk them out of their failure disease. I do that for my dear sister who is an Ojibwe language speaker and teacher and cultural teacher, and she's hitting the brunt of a lot of the stuff that happens in the community, and supporting her and her efforts. And so I just, it's about really being able to shed the habenula, not to deny it, but just to say, no, I refuse to believe that I cannot do anything here. And then I'm on a search. And searching is the most powerful emotional network that we have. It dominates fear, anger, you know, love, desire,
seeking,
you know,
to be a
all
seeker,
of these things,
right?
To be
a seeker, to seek. Yeah, if you want to have a real nice shortcut to get yourself into the right frame of mind, just go on a search. Be curious, you know, like look for something. Mm. You know, and we abuse it all the time by looking for the perfect pair of shoes or whatever the case may be.
Yeah,
but that's why it works to get our mind off of things. Is when we're searching for the next video or the next thing to watch, we're trying to manage subconsciously the anger, the fear, and the sadness that are sort of running in the backdrop. So it's a really good remedy to really sort of make contact with what you can do, because then the more that your brain is watching you make contact, even in little ways, the more you feel empowered. Empowerment is a accumulative savings account. Like, it just keeps accumulating and gaining interest and dividends all the time. And so that's where I place my focus.
Mm. You know, I always say, I won't throw out the good in pursuit of the perfect. And that's the iterative,
right?
You know, mindset, that making these small gains and having them build. And I want to say that what I want to honor in you, and I see in you, is a person who leads with their entire identity.
Uh-huh.
And if all of us would choose more authenticity and lead out of love and not fear, I think we could close the gap time
I do too.
We've been talking about.
That no do gap.
Maybe
thank
so.
You. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Kyra.
It's been a joy.
It's been an incredible conversation. And I hope we can help amplify your work, and we'll be tracking and following. And I hope we can follow up and talk again sometime in the future.
Yeah.
Thank you for getting the word out.
Oh, absolutely. And for those who want to learn more about your work and the iterative mindset method, where can they find you and your new book?
So my personal website is drkyrabobinet.com. My company is FreshTri, spelled TRI.com. And that's for the software side, but you can find the book either way. And it's on Amazon pre-orders for right now. And
Wonderful. That's
the best way to kind of get started.
And we will have all this information in the show notes, on our website, everywhere. We're grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyra.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for being part of this Sage Against the Machine community.
If you were inspired, intrigued, or activated by our discussion, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Stay connected with us on Instagram and LinkedIn for updates, behind-the-scenes content, and to share your thoughts on today's topic.
And if you have any ideas for future episodes or concepts you'd like us to cover, feel free to reach us at our website, sageagainstthemachine.com, for additional resources and exclusive content.
Until next time, stay hopeful.
The evidence of change is out there.
Thanks for joining us as we
Sage Against the Machine.